This week on Bill Moyers Journal, two views on what America can learn from Katrina.
When you destroy your ecological base, civilization collapses. That's what we saw in South Louisiana. You know, 1 million acres of wetlands disappeared, creating a watery flight path for Katrina to slam into New Orleans like a plane into the World Trade Center.
Racial injustice allowed for environmental injustice because we saw poor people and Southern people and Black people as less valuable to the nation.
And he spent a lifetime unraveling the mysteries of religion.
Since we're not going to get rid of science or religion, how do we find better ways to get along?
And Bill's take on Karl Rove on this episode of Bill Moyers Journal. Major funding is provided by the Partridge Foundation, a John and Polly Guth charitable fund. Park Foundation, dedicated to heightening public awareness of critical issues. The Kohlberg Foundation. The Herb Alpert Foundation, Marilyn and Bob Clements, and the Clements Foundation, Bernard and Audrey Rappaport, and the Bernard and Audrey Rappaport Foundation, the Fetzer Institute, the Orfila Family Foundation, the Public Welfare Foundation, and by our sole corporate sponsor, Mutual of America, providing retirement plan products and services to employers and individuals since 1945. Mutual of America. Your retirement company. From our studios in New York, Bill Moyers.
Welcome to the Journal. Bells will soon ring out in New Orleans to mark the second anniversary of Hurricane Katrina.
Days after Katrina struck, President Bush offered reassurance to the refugees and homeless from the Big Easy to Biloxi.
I understand the anxiety of people on the ground, but I want people to know there's a lot of help coming.
After a flyover of the region, the president appeared in the White House Rose Garden with his cabinet.
We are dealing with one of the worst natural disasters in our nation's history. I can't tell you how devastating the sites were.
But no one really needed to be told. The images had circled the world.
Throughout the area hit by the hurricane, we will do what it takes. We will stay as long as it takes to help citizens rebuild their communities and their lives.
That was then. This is now. Nearly two-thirds of the city's population has returned, but many of the city services they depend upon haven't. Less than half of the city's schools are open. 10 of the 23 original New Orleans hospitals remain closed. The city's police headquarters and two of its precinct stations still operate from temporary trailers, struggling to contain a crime level that has remained at a high water mark. For a realistic look at what it's like now, check out places like YouTube, where a few students, church groups, and animal rescuers have videotaped parts of the Gulf Coast and neighborhoods like this, the Lower Ninth Ward, one of the hardest hit in New Orleans. That school bus lying on the ground, that car in the tree, and these swamped homes are still there 2 years later. Earlier this summer, representatives from Louisiana and Mississippi went to Washington to complain about the slow pace of recovery, much of it due, they said, to red tape with FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Meanwhile, the Associated Press reports that tax breaks intended for reconstruction of homes destroyed by Katrina are being used to build luxury condos hundreds of miles inland from where Katrina hit, conveniently near the University of Alabama football stadium.
I'm joined now by two people who haven't been able to get Katrina off their minds. Mike Tidwell is the writer and environmental activist who back in 2003 predicted something like Katrina would sweep across the Gulf. In Bayou Farewell, Tidwell warned that the barrier islands and wetlands that would have slowed a major hurricane had long since disappeared because of the decision to dam the Mississippi. In his most recent bestseller, The Ravaging Tide, Tidwell warns that future Katrinas, fueled by global warming, are likely to take aim at other coastal cities with equally devastating effects. Melissa Harris-Lacewell is here, too, her second visit with us. She teaches politics and African-American studies at Princeton University and wrote the award-winning book Barbershops, Bibles, and BET, exploring how African Americans develop their political point of view. She was a principal investigator for the University of Chicago's study on racial attitudes and the Katrina disaster. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Why do we ignore the warnings? We ignored the warnings before 9/11. We ignored the warnings before Katrina. I mean, you wrote in your book that Katrina's arrival was as certain as tomorrow's sunrise.
That's right.
How could you be so sure?
Because all you had to do was look at the coastal maps going back from the French explorers all the way to the satellite maps from the mid-1970s forward, and you saw a coastal landmass imploding, disappearing. An area the size of Delaware was subtracted from South Louisiana between New Orleans and the Gulf of Mexico just since the Great Depression. It was clear that there was no longer any landmass buffering the city. Why do we ignore these warnings? It's you know, we are evolved to respond to claws and fangs in our faces. That's what we're evolved to. We're not evolved to see that threat coming in the distance. And even when we know that, you know, people in Louisiana saw the land disappearing below their feet, but times were good. The shrimp harvests were great. Tourism was booming in South Louisiana. The energy industry was booming. And so it was easy to laisser le bon temps rouler, you know, just forget about that threat. And because it wasn't claws and fangs in our face the way we were evolved to respond to for the evolution of human beings, it was easy to say it's not going to happen, to deny. And that's what led ultimately to the calamity.
The question is, from my perspective as a political scientist, what are our collective responsibilities to one another, to our nation, to our land, to our planet? What are we going to do in terms of who we are for making resiliency in the face of disaster possible? Because the human experience is going to be that we're going to face a variety of negative, disastrous experiences. Is it going to always be that the relatively privileged are going to be able to escape while the miner's canary dies in the mine?
I've kept in my file a story written 1 week after the disaster. Listen to this. What Hurricane Katrina exposed was the psychological consequence of the welfare state. 75% of the residents of New Orleans had already evacuated before the hurricane, and of those who remained, a large number were from the city's public housing projects. What does that say to you?
Well, it's bizarre and inaccurate empirically because, in fact, the public housing projects were on high ground. They experienced very little water damage, and most of the residents there who have been shut out by their government, by their city, and by our national housing office is not because of any destruction that occurred because of Katrina, but because of the required evacuation that occurred. They were mostly safe. The people whose homes were destroyed were mostly homeowners, but they were poor people. And this is what we can't deal with in America. They worked jobs every day. Most of them stayed because they needed to go to work in the morning. Most of them had to go to work in the morning in the hotels, in the tourist industries, in the restaurants that served to make New Orleans the fun place that the rest of us like to visit. So they were homeowners who were poor. They were working people who were poor because we live in a country where we allow people to work every day and still be poor, to still have the inadequate capacity to leave. And the third reason why many people didn't leave are very thick social networks. So part of the question you asked is, why didn't people think, oh, this disaster is coming? Well, Betsy, Hurricane Betsy was in living memory in New Orleans. And Hurricane Betsy was a terrible storm that many people had survived. If you had an aunt or an uncle or a grandmother who had survived Hurricane Betsy, she or he refused often to leave. And what these thick social networks of black families and poor families did in New Orleans was they didn't leave and then leave grandma there to die. They stayed. If the Hurricane Betsy survivor refused to go because she'd lived through it, everybody stayed. And I don't think that reflects anything about the welfare state in this narrow way. That reflects how poor communities get together with one another because they are the only resources that they have.
But I think the true tragedy, As we look at the Ninth Ward, we look at Lakeview and these neighborhoods that are not being rebuilt, the city of New Orleans is effectively being abandoned. It really is. And we're not doing what we know we can do to save it. The city can be saved. I completely believe that. People should, and we can save this city. And we have to do a number of things. We have to restore the wetlands in Barrier Islands. We've got to make levees that work. And we must save the city, but we're not doing it. And the real...
Would you take your family to live there?
No, I would not. I would not go move to New Orleans. It's the most dangerous city in the world to live
why?
In. The levees are ineffective. The Army Corps of Engineers says it's going to be 2010 before they even have the levees up to pre-Katrina levels. And then climate change. Hurricanes are getting bigger. We know this. There have been MIT studies, Georgia Tech studies that show that it's already happening. It is a dangerous place to live. Now, if we resolve the issue of climate change, which we can. The tragedy is we can fix New Orleans. It's not a matter of money and technology. We can do it. You know, in the war in Iraq 6 weeks early, you have the $30 billion to build the levees in the wetlands. And climate change. If we became a nation of hybrid car drivers 10 years from now, we cut our gasoline use in half. We wouldn't be in Iraq. If Iraq's number one export was broccoli, would we be there? So the tragedy is we can, in fact, save New Orleans, but we're not doing it. We can solve global warming, but we're not doing it. And I think the main thing for people who live in Miami, who live in Lower Manhattan, who live in Charleston, all these vulnerable coastal cities, if we allow New Orleans to disappear, if we don't come to the permanent rescue of our fellow countrymen in New Orleans, how are you safe in Miami? How are you safe in Lower Manhattan? Who's going to come to save you?
But isn't the lesson of that we shouldn't be building, developing, doing what we want to with nature in places that are vulnerable?
But this is, I think, part of what's dangerous about the saying, well, the problem is that New Orleans is dangerous environmentally. It is, right? But so, too, are lots of places that very wealthy people like to live because they're very beautiful. Some of the most beautiful places are on fault lines or on coastlines likely to get hit by hurricanes. Or I think we
Downtown
should...
Downtown Wall Street,
in Wall Street. That's right. I mean, in an age of terrorism, if you live in a major urban center, it certainly is clear that we have environmental issues that must be addressed. But it's also important that as we talk about the right of citizens to return to their city, that we're clear that we already give that right, the right to live in vulnerable environmental places, exists for the wealthy. We simply are unwilling to extend that same freedom of choice, freedom to rebuild community. It's not just if you live in Miami or Lower Manhattan or D.C. It's if you live anywhere. What we do by refusing to underline the importance of living in a chosen community is we say that as a country, we simply don't value those issues. We look at your home and your home is worth whatever, $10,000 to us. That's all of what your life is, all of your family, your connections, your school, your church. It's worth $10,000 to us. We cannot be that country. We must be a country that recognizes the value of local community.
What have you learned, the two of you, about politics, American politics, from the Katrina disaster?
Well, I often say that Hurricane Katrina and its political aftermath is the 2006 win of the Democrats in the midterm elections. And it's,
how so?
I know, it seems odd because it's not as though Katrina is at all even talked about in the 2006 elections. But you'll remember that from September 11th, 2001 until August 28th of 2005, one was unpatriotic if you criticized the Bush administration or really any of the actions taken by our government. So the Democratic Party and much of the American media was quite timid in terms of its critique of the administration. But what Katrina and the bungling of Katrina does is it provides a wedge that opens the door, and the criticisms start to flow from CNN, from the Democratic Party. Now, the sad and scary thing is that all of these issues, urbanism, race, class, environmentalism, which were the true core issues that make Katrina possible, get lost. Because what the Democratic Party makes a choice to do is to use that wedge as an opportunity to critique Iraq. Not that it's fine, right? But they use that, and so then Iraq becomes the story of the 2006 elections.
At the expense of Katrina?
At the expense of Katrina and all the lessons that Katrina had the capacity to teach us about domestic politics.
Well, I think there's a lot of blame, if you will, to go around in terms of politics, but I would take a slightly different course. 1,800 dead, $100 billion in economic damage, 1 million people were displaced by Katrina. Our president went to Jackson Square a week after Katrina, stood there in an abandoned city, and he says, we will stay here as long as it takes, and we will do whatever it takes to bring the city back. And just like after 9/11, the whole country said, tell us what to do. Lead us. We want to help. We want to respond as a nation. We want to respond as one community. Everyone was horrified by what happened. And that commitment simply wasn't there. In the fall of 2005, it took till right before Christmas to get $3 billion just to begin rebuilding the levees. Are you kidding me? 1,800 dead? It took us the entire fall of 2005. And that's because the president really did not sustain his commitment. He did not say, this is as important to me as the Iraq War. This is as important to me as tax breaks for the rich. I'm going to roll up my sleeves. And as a result, the media stopped covering it. And the American people felt like they wrote a check, they took care of it. Surely, if the president's not on Jackson Square every week telling us, giving us a progress report, everything must be okay. If you go to New Orleans right now, if you go there tomorrow in 2007, you would think the hurricane happened last week. You have a bubble of a society still devastated by that hurricane. And you get outside that coastal bubble, and it's as if the hurricane didn't happen. And that's because our leaders don't continue to say it's an issue.
If someone had looked at that coverage, and instead of saying, oh, my God, look at all of these refugees on the roofs of their home, if someone had said, look at all those Democratic voters trapped out there in the waters, because that's who they are. They're a bunch of Democratic voters, that maybe the party would have thought, okay, if George Bush isn't here every day, then we should be. We should be standing in Jackson Square every day and holding accountable. I don't allow or accept that simply because there was a party in power, even more so, therefore, that the Democrats who were in local power there, not just at the city level, but the state level, and even at the national level, could have started to provide leadership.
Are you saying that the response to Katrina on the part of the Democratic Party should have been, we can win the election in 2008 if we exploit this?
No, it should have been here, standing here at this moment, is the questions of why the Democratic Party, from its own understandings of itself as a progressive liberal institution, should be able to do better. That this was a moment where you had national outrage, where you had Southerners together in solidarity for the experience that they had just had, where you had environmentalism, which is Al Gore's central key issue, where you had urban issues coming, all of the things that the Democrats say that they're good at. This is the moment to provide leadership. I'm not talking about exploitation. I'm saying you claim this is what you're good at. Let's see you do it. Let's see you talk about how we build a progressive coalition of working people in the South.
But changing the course of a mighty river created an attractive situation where people lived and industry flourished and we did all of these things, fishing and so forth, but then nature struck back. I mean, you can't in the end really refute nature, can you?
Well, you can live sustainably with nature. And there's been a plan developed since the mid-90s in South Louisiana called the Coast 2050 Plan that says, look, we already live here. We already have industry here. We already have homes here. We can't just let the river go back to its natural state of, you know, 1,000 years ago where it is a wild state. How can we live, however, sustainably with the river? How can we allow the sediments and nutrients of the river back into the coastal areas to rebuild wetlands and barrier islands in a way without destroying property? And it can be done, and it has been done elsewhere in the world. We can live sustainably with this great river. It will take money. It will take nothing compared to what we've already lost.
What do you say about the issue of corruption to the wealthy people, the wealthy investors, the real estate dealers who are ripping off the special provisions for Katrina in order to build luxury condos at the University of Alabama football stadium? Are the corruption in City Hall in New Orleans or the school system in New Orleans or the police department in New Orleans, what do you say about the power of corruption to frustrate the good intentions of the people that both of you know?
Well, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King already told us that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And that is true in this case, that the people of New Orleans and of the Gulf Coast, the survivors of Katrina, are the miners' canaries of our nation, right? That we know that the miners took the canaries down into the mine because canaries have sensitive respiratory systems. So if a noxious gas was released into the mine, the canary would die first. And this was an indication that the miners should get out. So when the vulnerable people of New Orleans are and of the Gulf Coast and all of the survivors of Katrina are treated as tools to enrich the powerful, this is a miner's canary for the rest of us. Be clear, you are not safe anywhere from corruption. You are not safe anywhere from this kind of profiteering. You are not safe anywhere if we don't look at the very simple sort of policy choices that we could have made. For example, a huge communal land grab of the lower Ninth Ward. In other words, set up a CDC, a community development corporation, so that instead of each individual homeowner somehow trying to rebuild their houses, you set up a community-based development that allows all of the block to be built all together at once instead of one house at a time, right? And then you allow this Community Development Corporation, a nonprofit, to hold the interest of the homeowners and sell back to the homeowners. Instead, what we did was we wrote checks to poor and working people, most of whom had mortgages on their destroyed homes. So you're standing there and you've got a mortgage and your home is destroyed. You can't rebuild with that check. You pay off your mortgage with it. Now you're standing there with nothing. These were simple things. We could have made a community development corporation. We could have forgiven in a mass way. We could have done what we did with the SNL bailouts. And we could have bailed out mortgage holders, simply wiping away their mortgages because of this. So we had very clear tools. And instead, we decided to make this an opportunity for profit, an opportunity for profit-driven real estate speculators to come in and make money from this.
Have financial and political corruption reached a state in American life in this prosperous age so that we are impotent to do things, to meet the challenges we face?
We're not impotent. Right now, we are in a crisis of abusive wealth. The disparity in income has never been worse in this country. But are we impotent to change it? We are not. I think that ultimately, as I look to Katrina on the second anniversary, I'm reminded of a fascinating sociological study that was done in Indonesia after the great tsunami. And there was one culture along the Indonesian coast that was hit hardest that, for whatever reasons, had this long oral tradition to treat with respect the power of tsunamis. And the tsunami was at the core of their oral history and their ongoing value system. When you see that tsunami take higher ground, it is nature. It is something to be respected. And those people in that community fled to higher ground and were not devastated in the way the other communities were. All the rest of the communities in this area, in the tsunami, they saw it coming. And they stood there and they watched it and they were overcome by it and they died. Katrina was a tsunami that we saw coming from miles away, and we stood there and we watched it, and it got closer and closer, and we did not prepare. We did not escape our state of denial. We wanted to believe that wealth and convenience was everything and let the good times roll, and we got wiped out. And the same thing is happening with global warming. The tsunami's happening. We're watching it coming. We're standing on the beach, and we're not protecting ourselves. We've got to somehow rise above history. We've got to not follow the mistakes of previous...
You can't rise above history. You can't. History is us. It's this corruption in Alabama, this corruption... History is us.
Yes. It's also the corruption, but it's also always the resistance against it. So the story of enslavement, right, the great American evil of enslaving human beings for hundreds of years is also the story of enslaved people resisting it at every step, right? So the story is always both the corruption and abuse of power and the unbelievable human capacity to still recognize the value of human life. Because the fact is, right, the planet goes on. If global warming wipes
us out...
He says
it may not go on.
The planet goes on. Right, the planet goes on. The planet decides we're a plague that's warming it up too fast. It wipes us out. But the planet goes on. So... even a fight against global warming is a belief that human beings matter. It's a kind of essential belief that there's something inside of human beings worth saving. Because if we're really just corrupt and bad and evil, then heat it up. Let it wipe us out.
What gives me optimism in the face of this overwhelming challenge, and Katrina really is a curtain raiser. If you want to know what Miami's going to look like 100 years from now, go to New Orleans today. Below sea level, behind levees, battered by huge storms, if we don't stop global warming. This climate crisis is here now. The Great Lakes are dropping in water levels. Texas has got too much rain. The Carolinas too little. Hurricanes are getting... It's here now. It's not a maybe thing in the future that computer modeling says is coming. It's already deeply here. So the fact that it's here, that this giant climate system with all the momentum built in it toward warming is already unpacking its bags, what could possibly give us the optimism and hope that we can now respond at this late stage strongly and fiercely enough to hold it in check? And that the thing that I come back to is when we decide to change, we tend to change explosively. Look at the great changes in World War II and all these things that have happened in the 20th century. I believe that this issue of climate change and sustainability, which also implies questions of human rights and fairness. When this light bulb finally goes on And it's going on. You know, I think Katrina opened the door. Al Gore walked through it, and the zeitgeist has changed. There's a lot more on climate change. But once we finally really get serious, we're going to change really fast.
Well, and who are we to give up? I mean, I'm a black woman living in America at a time when at any other point in America, I would have been enslavable. I would have been Jim Crowed. I'm a professor at Princeton University. Who am I to give up? How dare I give up and say, well, oh, we can't fix it. It can't be done. When people overcame, I mean, people who are my people, my grandmother, who was a domestic worker, my father, who went to Jim Crow public schools, how dare I give up? I feel like we just have too much privilege to be the ones to give up.
Yeah, but those folks down there in New Orleans, they're not at Princeton.
No, but they're also not enslaved, and they're also not sharecroppers. That I think something bad happens when we imagine that we're living at the worst time. This is the worst thing that we've ever faced. It's a serious thing. It's possibly the worst time for the planet. it is possibly. But still, who are we with freedom of speech, with freedom of press, with free and open elections every 4 years? Who are we to give up? We're telling the people of Baghdad, grip it up, pull it together, do better, stop sectarian violence. How dare we, as Americans, with everything, be the ones to give up?
What about you, Bill? I mean, how do you maintain a sense of hope?
By listening to people like you. Mike Tidwell and Melissa Harris-Lacewell, thank you very much for being on The Journal. If you were browsing through your favorite neighborhood bookstore and came upon a book with the title The Mystery of the Child, odds are you wouldn't likely think the author to be one of the country's most distinguished historians, especially when the cover has the filmatic quality of this one. But there it is, a name historians and readers of history will recognize immediately, Martin E. Marty. This is the latest of over 50 books he's produced over his long and productive life, including Righteous Empire, winner of the National Book Award, the three-volume Modern American Religion, and the one in the many, America's Struggle for the Common Good. He's also written four books with one of his sons, the photographer Micah Marty. More recently, this past president of the American Academy of Religion, winner of the National Humanities Medal, recipient of 72 honorary doctorates, and admiral in the Nebraska Navy, was one of the leaders of a project on the child in law, religion, and society at Emory University in Georgia. And that brings us to his book, The Mystery of the Child. Drawing on literature as new as today's poetry and as old as the Bible, Martin Marty encourages all of us to maintain the child's openness to wonder as we grow old. You're a historian. You've got a life's work to show for it, including over 50 books. But this book is not a history, and there's very little in what you've done ever to suggest that you would write a book about children. So why did you write it?
I think it was the stage of life where I was really ready for this. Just a couple of days ago, I was in the apartment of an art dealer. We got to talk about the revival of interest in the artist Georges Rouault, who'd been big 50 years ago and then in decline. Most of his work was brutal, brusque. One series was called Man as a Wolf to Man. Corrupt judges, prostitutes. And suddenly, in his 70s, he painted Jesus on the way to Emmaus, resurrection, bright green, yellow, white, and so on. And they said, why are you doing that? He said, I've spent my life painting shadows. I think I've earned the right to paint the dawn. And I think there's a certain sense when you're a historian, you see all the corruption all the time, and I wanted to do a dawn book.
Well, it's interesting because in most of the histories I've ever read, children appear very rarely. I mean, even though they're affected by the plagues and the wars and the famines and the catastrophes and the crusades and all of that, children seem to be left out of history.
That's changing. Since women have entered the writing force, for one thing, my successor at the University of Chicago writes about how New Englanders, Jonathan Edwards types, brought up their children in that. So we're discovering it now. But there was almost total void.
Because you think men see the world differently?
Men see the world in terms of power, big events, wars, treaties, who gets elected, who tromps on whom. That's basically the plot of most history. But children are not a big part of it. And yet in my personal life, they almost, I won't say dominate because I don't like the word, but they're very upfront.
You've got quite an extended family, I know.
Yes, it changes the number all the time. My late first wife and I had four sons. And then we took in as foster and equivalent of adoption, because that's 40 years ago, two Mexican children, brother and sister. And then I married the widow of my college roommate, who died when their baby was 8 weeks old. And we would take in people, French student or so. One year we had two boys from Uganda, 9 and 12 year old. And there were seven boys aged 9 to 14 around the table every day for better than a year. So it's always been that. And now I'm in the stage of having great-grandchildren.
Great-grandchildren. What has it meant to you to have such a pluralistic family?
Partly it's accidental. We just said the door's open. We believed both by nature and by our own children's generosity. They always had a vote.
Let me come back to your book. What do you mean by the mystery of the child's life? What do you mean by that?
A great French philosopher, Gabriel Marcel, makes a difference between a problem and a mystery. A problem, says Marcel, is something that I can isolate. Problems, he says, have solutions or potential solutions. Mysteries don't. Mysteries have depth. Mysteries are unfathomable. And I just love watching our children, watching grandchildren, watching great-grandchildren, watching babies, watching just anybody, the unfolding of that package, which you can explain a lot of in scientific terms, but you never really capture what happens.
So do you think those of us who deal with children, grandparents, parents, caregivers, would deal with them differently if we see them as a mystery instead of a problem?
Definitely. I think two impulses we have that the concept of mystery will lead you to treat differently. Marcel, who says, a problem stands outside me, mystery, I'm inside it. Mystery, I can't get distance on myself or it or that other person. You're drawn into seeing the world in their angle. I would like to take people to the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago, and put everything is done. The chairs we're sitting in are 7 feet tall, and you're there, and the spoon is this long. And I try to think back, that's what it looks like to the child. And we wonder why the child falls and pushes things around. If you're dealing with a mystery of the child, you're inside it.
Now, in that exhibit, there's a huge table, big silverware, and you imagine falling off that if you're a
that's
child.
That's right. The great French novelist, Georges Bernanos, did a thing called The Diary of a Country Priest, and became a great film, too. And this priest has trouble with his catechism class. Somebody smarts off at him. He talks to a monsignor, and he's really down on children. And the monsignor says to him, probably no more terrifying sentence has ever been heard by human ears than this, quote, unless you change and become like a little child, you shall not enter the kingdom. And in a funny way, while not every reader of the book is going to have the concept of the kingdom, I think that notion that you spend your life finding ways to change and become like a little child means you will be more open to mystery, more responsive to others, more receptive.
That is one of Jesus's most perplexing questions. Unless you become as children, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. What do you think he meant by that?
I had a late, great colleague at Chicago, Paul Ricoeur, who once said, you'll never understand a parable of Jesus until you realize that everyone turns things upside down. The littlest seed becomes the greatest tree. The lost sheep's more important than those that weren't ever lost. The people not invited to the banquet get head tables. You have to die in order to live. In the Gospel of Luke, he's always interested in the marginal people. The poor, the prostitutes, the tax collectors who are hated, they're the oppressor, people with leprosy, everybody who didn't count. And in that world, children didn't count. And so putting the child there makes that central.
He's not talking about a second childhood.
Oh, no. A second childhood would be out entirely, because a second childhood isn't faithful to the first childhood. Second child is what we consider as what happens as tragic. It's an old name for things like Alzheimer's or senility or dementia. That's always seen as a diminishing of life. And it's tragic, and it's there, and you don't get away from it. But it's not a second childhood, because childhood is always opening, always
potential,
more is going to
growing,
happen.
Yeah. Maturing.
So I did find one dictionary that had a word I needed. I don't like to coin words, but if I can find one dictionary, it had the word childness.
Yeah.
This is that character, and I even quote a couple of Catholic theologians who talked about how you keep some of these qualities from the life of the child through all the contingencies of life. And if you, Bill Moyers, make a list of the people you most admired when they're in their 80s and 90s, they keep that dimension of childhood. Pablo Casals said, I'm the oldest cellist in the world. I'm the oldest musician. I'm also the youngest.
We met Pablo Casals many years ago when my wife and I were young in Washington. He said, I want you to be young, young all your life, and to say things to the world that are true.
That's always his last word. Yes, children can lie, but when they tell stories, fanciful as they may be, to that child they're unfolding a truth. And that's why so often we collect what they say. Mm-hmm. When mothers sit in the park and chat about the children, they're quoted as if they're sages, because they do say things that impart a kind of a wisdom. But I think Casals meant more than that. Casals also would go to the piano every day, and he'd play two of Bach's two-part inventions. The simplest looking music you can find, the third-year piano student plays them badly. But he had to start over every day. He had to get a new start. That was his way to do it.
You say children are receptive, mm-hmm. responsive, amenable, simple, teachable, relatively helpless, insignificant, unimposing, lacking status, dependent. Of such is the kingdom of God.
Because any of those can change. Take the opposite of everything you just said, and you can't change. Like an autumn leaf. All the sap has gone out of it, and you can't change now because there's nowhere to go. Which is why I also make a great point of the value of conversation and questioning as opposed to arguing. Argument is extremely important. I want my legislators to argue. You can't have justice without argument. I want my medical researchers to argue about which cell does what. It's beautiful in its place, but in the mysteries of life, arguing is there a God or not? Where will argument get you? Where's the evidence? Where's the either side? You can't get anywhere there. You do it through conversation. And all the great thinkers that I know of do that. Again, the gospel stories of Jesus, they want to attack him with an argument, and he asks a question.
He tells a story, too, or asks a question.
Indeed, every time. I think one of the problems that happened in the transmission of knowledge in our adult world is the way on so much of television now, you always choose the two most extreme figures who will lose everything if they yield any point. And it never contributes to truth. I've been invited several times to debate one of the new school of atheists. And as you and every listener has to know, that these four or five all say that if you just get rid of all religion, the world would be benign and peaceful. Well, my question is, how do you explain Mao and Stalin and Lenin and all of the great totalitarians, all of whom set out to get rid of God and religion and kill several hundred million people? I'm not defending the religious record. There's horrible stuff out there. Right. And I make a lot of my living in my noisy books about describing that. But you're not going to get rid of religion. You can't suppress this impulse. It's increasing, not decreasing. And you can't sit at Oxford or Harvard or Chicago and say, the world would be nice if other people would get their PhDs in physics and learn enough to know that isn't it. Religion is in the villages of Latin America. It's in the villages of the Islamic world. Every seventh person in the world was a Muslim 50 years ago. Now every fifth person is growing. In sub-Saharan Africa, 18,000 new Christians every day. You're not going to have somebody sit up here on television and talk them out of it. So the issue, I changed it to the question. Since we're not going to get rid of science or religion, how do we find better ways to get along? I grew up theologically at the time when everybody envisioned the world was going to be purely secular. Secular, empirical, pragmatic, etc. The people who prophesied that said, but notice that every great philosopher of history of the last century pictures that either following that over against it, you're going to have a period of, I'll call it neo-religiosity. They weren't saying something comforting there. They were saying it could be a religion of nationalism, it could be a religion of race, it could be a religion of violence. We see a lot of that. But it's going to be there. And so to me, the interesting question is, how do the two coexist? Which you can't debate the fundamental point of it.
Do you see the pendulum swinging either way?
We live under a twofold sign. On one level, we are more secular than anybody envisioned back in the Enlightenment. But religious people are that. Think of how much in the religious right turned secular when they got away from piety into pure politics, when they're only asking this question. Years ago, David Martin, a great British sociologist of religion, said, here's the paradox of the modern world. I can summarize it all in one phrase. Texas Baptist millionaire. They are in church, and they don't want their minister to mention anything in the modern world. Oil depletion allowances, they didn't want anything discussed like that. They wanted otherworldliness and save. On the other hand, they're utterly immired in it. We all are in some degree. I'm secular in that I don't believe that I have to ask for the Holy Spirit when I turn the ignition of a car. It's following secular principles. Secular comes from the world meaning of this age. Now, that's growing. And it's interesting, it grows in some parts of the world. I have a mental map that I call the spiritual ice belt. It starts west of Poland as Western Europe, British Isles, I used to say except Ireland, but Ireland is now secular, Canada, Northern U.S., Japan. That's the spiritual ice belt, in which there are all kinds of religions and there are all kinds of renewals of religion, but overall, it is the world of the pragmatic and the contractual and so on. You don't walk into the faculty clubs of these places and expect a revival. But we're totally out of step with all the rest of the world, all of Central and Latin America, all of Africa, Northern and Sub-Saharan, all of Asia. It teems. And again, to get back to the point of can you get rid of it, when the Iron Curtain fell, 72 years had gone by, in which you had the most efficient, ruthless system yet to get rid of religion. You spill oceans of blood to get there. You kill the priests. You use rivers of ink to argue about it. The day that fell, every religion that was there in 1917 is still there, and some new ones.
Let me come to this book you wrote called When Faiths Collide. I happen to know, as many of our audience do, that you, for 5 years, chaired a very important study of fundamentalism a number of years ago. And we've seen in your lifetime and mine the resurgence of fundamentalism. At the same time, we have seen, as you noted earlier, we've seen the rise of a more evangelical atheism. Where are these surges going to lead? The surge of fundamentalism and the surge of disbelief.
Well, the surge of fundamentalism is going to outnumber the literate atheists by hundreds of thousands to one. What did Kafka once say? In the fight between you and the world, bet on the world. In the fight between these two forces, bet on the zealot. Though the atheist can be all these same things too. So in that sense, the religious fundamentalist, who's closed in the terms of the child book, and the secular fundamentalist in atheism have a lot in common. But your question is also a different question, namely, where does it lead? We may not have much time because these things used to just be allowed to be around, and now with weaponry being what it is, the game can end a lot sooner than we might think. But as we used to say, all things being equal, if you just let things work out in the give and take of politics and history and so on, I think that the extreme hard line, which now is tied into tribalism and politics and militarism and so on, in the end is not satisfying to all the questions that people are going to keep asking. You do it on the short range. You do it under the leadership of a charismatic leader. You do it if you hate somebody else enough.
But the world seems divided now between those who welcome a clash of good and evil, those who believe that militant fundamentalism has to be met with militant a response on that. Does this scare you?
It scares me, but I think there are a lot of gradations between the two alternatives. I want defense. I don't want anybody who wants to can smuggle a nuke into New York. I'm conscious of all that. But the talk of Islamofascism and all these ways in which we've got to be as full of machismo as they do, toward what end? As I look back, did we fight Hitler and Japanese more militantly because we demonized them? Demonizing the other, I don't think, helps the cause, and it does bad stuff to us. It assumes, therefore, we've got it made. So alertness, yes. Defense, yes. But saying the only way to do it is at all times to build up the clash of civilizations. I think it's folly, it's expensive, and it hurts the soul.
Let me come back to your book. Is the soul of a child different in one period of her life from the other periods of her life?
Then you have to let me define soul.
Go right ahead. You have my blessing.
I'll do it with Allah, colleague Leon Cass, whom know, and behind him, Aristotle.
He's a biologist, an ethicist.
And he was head of the President's Commission on Stem Cell
taught
Research.
Taught it with you at Chicago, for the University of Chicago, for a long time.
And in one of his books on the development of soul out of Darwinian roots, soul is not a ghost in the machine. Soul is not a pilot on a ship. Soul is not a thing. Soul, and here's Aristotle and Cass and me translating them, is the integrated, vital power of any organic body open to possibility and future. If I say she has a generous soul, you don't need to know much more about her, right? Mm-hmm. If I would take a word, spoiled brat, I've condensed a person and said there's no soul there. I may be making false judgment, and I'm writing somebody off prematurely. I don't believe in doing that. But if I'm doing that, I'm really saying it's no longer vital. It isn't open to a future. It's closed. I use a lot in the book about the image of open and closed.
Do you think children ponder the mystery of life?
Oh, I think so all the time.
Even at a young age?
Indeed. It comes up in, why did my kitty die, and what happened? Will I meet my dog in heaven? Why is everybody crying? Because grandma's sick. I think those are things we lose later on. And I think we sometimes can get sense that better in a quote, primitive culture, which keeps some of these dimensions. One of my sons was in Africa when his mother died. 10 people of the tribe moved into his house for 10 days. That's just what they do, to console and to beat drums and to make the food and do all that. We have traces of that in our religions, but if you go to the typical last rites, again, everything is in control. The makeup on the stuffed body is there, the greeting you give in the funeral home, I express my sympathy and so on, it's gone. Not the child. The child is really, really going to cry and then go out and skip and play hopscotch and do all the rest, because they're not done in by a single circumstance.
Yeah, kids know today that bad things happen all the time.
Yeah. I did a TV film with 9 little kids after 9/11. Producer said children, they were told that children would be all terrified by that. But the one kid was from a ghetto, and he said, yeah, I have fears. I have fears that I go to school, my lunch money will be stolen. Coming home, I have fears that two gangs are going to fight over which gang I'm going to be in. He's translating these fears all the while, and his dream is of a better setup.
You're about to become how old?
80.
Are you becoming, as Jesus said, like a child all over again?
I'm trying to take lessons to do it appropriately to the age. When you say becoming it again, I hope I was at 70 and 60 and 50 and 40, appropriate to the age. But if I learned well, I was being that. I quote, my teacher at one stage was Daniel Boorstin, later Librarian of Congress. And he dedicated a book, when I was studying under him, he dedicated a book to his children. And that dedication meant more than the book to me, to Jonathan, David, and Paul, quote, like genius, simple, that's why they are the great teachers. Mm-hmm. Pablo Casals playing those Bach two-part inventions is choosing simple music.
Simple?
Simple.
I don't think Bach is simple. But I'm not a musician, obviously. But
if you play Rachmaninoff's concerto, you would look back to these little two-part inventions as being something that music teacher uses. Now you don't exhaust them. He plays them because they're inexhaustible.
Yeah. You quote in here a Jesuit thinker who says, "The real high point of my life is still to come." What do you make of that?
Well, I'd like to think that.
At 80?
I hope at 90. I'm an utter realist about the fact that these powers can fail you, and they can miserably fail you. But I still detect in many people who see the loss of these powers, inventiveness, discover things they hadn't known. I tell a story in there of a jazz musician, Ed Summerlin, and I. We did a program. I was dedicating a building at a little college in Sioux City, Iowa, Morningside College. And the local church asked, could we do something for them? So I read a poem by Sam Francis called The Hawk, and he blew it. He blew what the hawk would do. He took the mouthpiece off and shrieked and all that. My mother's friends all applauded us. And one of them came up and said, are you still in town tomorrow morning? Well, we have a noon plane. Can you come to our senior citizens' home and do that there for all the other people? He said, I will if all of you will bring something that makes noise, with tissue paper or washboard or bell, I don't care what it is. For an hour, he did that. Most of them had never made music in their life, and they were not in second childhood. They were learning an unfolding in their wheelchairs. So several people have said, did you write this book as preparation for aging? No, I did it to try to understand the mystery of the child, but the whole thesis is that whatever is mysterious about the child is something we can constantly keep changing to be replenished by, and so we don't give up on people.
The book is The Mystery of the Child. Martin Marty, thank you very much for joining us.
A privilege to chat with you, to converse.
Some closing thoughts now on politics. When Karl Rove announced his resignation from the White House earlier this week, he got some rave reviews. Here's a sample circulating on the internet.
We should be congratulating Karl Rove for a long, successful run. This is a guy who elected a president twice, who's known as one of the most brilliant political activists of our time.
If you've ever talked to him, he's almost got almost like a blinders on. He looks right in the eye, and he talks faster than I do, really fast, right in your face, totally intent on you. And it's really like talking to a fire hydrant.
He's not only the mastermind behind everything, he's the president's senior advisor.
Boy genius, Bush's brain, the architect.
Karl is brilliant. He is funny. And he's a passionate advocate.
Karl Rove is a superstar. He is very insightful. He's a great friend to the president. And he's also a very broad thinker. He is one of the more intelligent people that I know. He's very quick-witted. He's got a great sense of humor, and the president will miss him.
But generally, where there's brains, there's Rove.
There is, of course, more to be said. What struck me about my fellow Texan Karl Rove is that he knew how to win elections as if they were divine interventions. You may think God summoned Billy Graham to Florida on the eve of the 2000 election to endorse George W. Bush just in the nick of time. But if it did happen that way, the good Lord was speaking in a Texas accent. Karl Rove figured out a long time ago that the way to take an intellectually incurious, draft-averse, naughty playboy in a flight jacket with chewing tobacco in his back pocket and make him governor of Texas was to sell him as God's anointed in a state where preachers and televangelists outnumber even oil derricks and jackrabbits. Using church pews as precincts, Rove turned religion into a weapon of political combat, a battering ram aimed at the devil's minions, especially at gay people. It's so easy, as Karl knew, to scapegoat people you outnumber. And if God is love, as rumor has it, Rove knew in politics to bet on fear and loathing. Never mind that in stroking the basest bigotry of true believers, you coarsen both politics and religion. At the same time he was recruiting an army of the Lord for the born-again Bush, Rove was also shaking down corporations for campaign cash. Crony capitalism became a biblical injunction. Greed and God won four elections in a row, twice in the Lone Star State and twice again in the nation at large. But the result has been to leave Texas under the thumb of big money with huge holes ripped in its social contract and the U.S. government in shambles, paralyzed, polarized, and mired in war, debt, and corruption. Rove himself is deeply enmeshed in some of the scandals being investigated as we speak, including those missing emails that could tell us who turned the Attorney General of the United States into a partisan sock puppet. Rove is riding out of Dodge City as the posse rides in. At his press conference this week, he asked God to bless the president and the country, even as reports were circulating that he himself had confessed to friends his own agnosticism. He wished he could believe, but he cannot. That kind of intellectual honesty is to be admired, but you have to wonder how all those folks on the Christian right must feel discovering they were used for partisan reasons by a skeptic, a secular manipulator. On his last play of the game, all Karl Rove had to offer them was a Hail Mary pass while telling himself there's no one there to catch it. That's it for the Journal. We'll be back next week. I'm Bill Moyers.